This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 6th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 189. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. The Tkemlops Indian Band says there is evidence that 215 children were buried in unmarked graves beside the former Kamloops Indian Residential School. It will take tens of millions of dollars and several years to investigate. What were their names, and why did they never make it home? The investigation of unmarked graves at a Florida reform school for boys offers a glimpse of what Kamloops can expect to unfold. My guest is Aaron Kimmerly, the forensic anthropologist who led the investigation in Marianna, Florida. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka in a can't-win situation? Much debate over her withdrawal from the French Open last week because she refused to attend mandatory news conferences. She says it is because of her mental health. Osaka's silverware includes the Odlum Brown Van Open trophy. Her first duty is to speak on court by winning. She knew becoming a pro would require speaking to media, but with corporate public relations, athletes can bypass media and go direct to fans. But with such a roster of prominent sponsors on her side, Osaka does have the resources to have what some less successful athletes don't have, a mental conditioning coach. But maybe it's also time for independent specialists to be available to assess the state of mind of athletes during and immediately after matches. There are physiotherapists, so why not psychotherapists? Also, we wouldn't expect Osaka to go in front of a microphone after suffering a serious ACL injury, so why should she meet with reporters if she suffers a bout of severe anxiety? Big money in sport has only gotten bigger through sponsors and media rights, sports gambling too. So it is important to hear from athletes, win or lose. Another reason for a non-appearance fine. Tennis is especially prone to corruption. There is now an International Tennis Integrity Association to stop match fixing. The sports world needs to find a balance that respects athletes, their fans, and upholds the integrity of the game. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Apple Daily, Mount Nicholson in Hong Kong sells the world's priciest parking space. A parking space at the luxury estate Mount Nicholson on the Peak sold for a record $1.31 million US, making it the most expensive parking space in the world. Jointly developed by Wharf Holdings and the Nanfeng Group, Mount Nicholson began the separate sales of parking spots last month, sold to the highest bidder. The fourth wife of the late Macau casino tycoon Stanley Ho purchased four units at the luxury estate as gifts to her two daughters. In the Taiwan news, video shows massive container crane collapse at Kaohsiung port. A dockside gantry crane collapsed at the container yard Yang Ming Marine Transport Corp. at the port of Kaohsiung. The container ship Durban, operated by Orient Overseas Container Line, veered off course and sideswiped the bow of YM Constancy. The Durban collided with the crane's boom as its pilot was unable to halt the hulking vessel's momentum. In ABC News Australia, New South Wales police charged three Sydney men over alleged plot to import $900 million of cocaine. Police began investigating after a man was seen gambling large amounts at a casino. U.S. Drug Enforcement and Coast Guard intercepted boats containing the drugs. The men were arrested after trying to access fake drugs in a storage unit. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Seattle Times, more than $2 million in prizes being offered to Washington residents as an incentive to get their COVID-19 vaccine. Washington Governor Jay Inslee is offering a $1 million grand prize, also tuition money for students, flights, sports tickets, and more. The vaccine incentive arrives as the virus is in decline in Washington and around the nation. The lottery will automatically gather names from the State Department of Health's immunization database. That means vaccinated residents don't need to do anything to be entered in the drawings, which have been dubbed the shot of a lifetime. In the Oregonian, twerking in a Portland bike lane during a protest, reasonable arrest or not? Was it unreasonable for Portland police to arrest a woman in August 2019 who was twerking in a bike lane downtown and flipped off officers during a protest? The committee voted 6-4 to affirm the Bureau's finding that the arrest was reasonable, though many members said they were disturbed by police actions. Alona Mitch, the 27-year-old woman charged, was acquitted of second-degree disorderly conduct in February 2020. In Czech news, Tassis residents urged to keep pets inside as wolf attacks continue. A small community on Vancouver Island is dealing with an influx in wolf activity that's leaving pets missing, injured, or killed, and making residents feel unsafe. The wolves began to show up 2 to 3 months ago, according to residents, with many reporting daytime sightings in the village on most days. 4 cats have been killed, 2 dogs were mauled. And these headlines in the Breaker.News. After money laundering probe heard last witness, NDP installed real estate exec as casino board chair. History says Vancouver Law Court's security unlikely to change even after vicious stabbing. And another glimpse inside North Island Mayor's lobbyist-led salmon farming campaign. Read the stories behind these headlines at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. On May 27th, the Tecumloops, the Kamloops Indian Band, announced that ground-penetrating radar found the remains of 215 children buried by the former Kamloops Residential School. It shook Canada, and it gained worldwide attention. Who were the children? What were their names? Why did they never make it home? Those questions will take tens of millions of dollars and many years to answer. On this edition of the Breaker.News podcast, I look south to Florida to find out what Kamloops can expect to unfold over the next several years. A team spent 4 years investigating unmarked graves at the Dozier School for Boys in Mariana on the Florida Panhandle. The Reform School operated from 1900 to 2011. It's where juvenile delinquents were warehoused. For more than half of its history, it was segregated. Black boys were the majority, and they were treated worse than whites in life and in death. They were as young as 5 and as old as 20. Many were abused and tortured. The Tampa Bay Times newspaper described victims in this headline. They went to the Dozier School for Boys Damaged. They came out destroyed. Joining me from Tampa, Florida, is University of South Florida forensic anthropologist Professor Aaron Kimmerly, who led the Dozier School investigation.
How many people were involved throughout the years from across disciplines, and where does the investigation sit now?
The core of the team was our research group, so it was forensic anthropologists and archaeologists, and then we had a lot of support from local law enforcement who worked with us on the missing person side of this and helping with DNA collection and analysis. And we had other volunteers from universities and archaeological groups who ultimately worked with us. So it turned out to be a pretty broad, big team. But the key in what we tried to bring to it and bring in different experts at times, genealogists, cultural anthropologists, archaeologists, historians, because a project like this and what you're facing with the Indian schools is really what I put in this category of a historic justice issue, and it can be very challenging, like what you're pointing out, because it doesn't fit a modern crime scene and it doesn't fit an archaeological project, research project, right? It's a justice issue, but it's historic. And so it falls between these kind of worlds of how we implement different resources and systems. And I think that for us, that was the biggest challenge. Because it didn't really fit anywhere, most people didn't want responsibility, no one wanted to pay for it, and there was a lot of pushback against the families. And the families of the brothers and their uncles, the boys that were buried there, were the people who were really pushing for this and who wanted this. And so, you know, I feel like our effort was supporting their rights and their, you know, right to access the justice system. So that's how we always framed it. And in the end, I think made a lot of good progress, but it had to, you have to kind of navigate those different worlds sometimes.
Beginning in 2013, Kimberly's team unearthed the remains of more than 50 people. So far, they identified 8, and they returned the remains to families. They believe they know the identities of another 14 victims. Investigators returned in 2019.
When we went back in 2019, that was because the land, since our investigation, the land had been turned over to the city of Mariana, where it's located. And they were starting a number of development projects, and there were known buried diesel tanks on the property that they wanted to remove in order to for construction. And so a CRM firm, a cultural resource management firm, was hired to do basically a survey looking for burials. And they said that they thought they found anomalies for 21 graves based on ground penetrating radar, GPR. And so we went back to investigate that. And if there were burials, we would exhume them as well. None of those turned out to be burials. They misinterpreted their data, basically. And so we searched that site. We searched additionally to make sure we didn't find any other burials there. I think that can happen easily when people use GPR and either don't, what we call ground truth. So what we did as we initially did our GPR work is we would dig what's called a test trench. And this is a trench or pits that are basically over the graves, but shallow enough that we would never intrude on them. We don't want to disturb burials that are there. But what that does is it allows you to look at the soil, and the soil tells the story about whether something was ever dug there and if that something is consistent with the grave. And then you can look at the pattern and the shape and the size of the whole site, and you start to put together that picture. So we did that. And when we started then excavating, almost a year later, we felt really comfortable, really confident that these are going to be, burials and not something else. But not everybody does that method, or they don't always ground truth it. And so that's where I think it's very important that they take that extra step in time and can really be confident in their results, and then also, help persuade politicians or law enforcement or whoever else needs to be convinced.
A big challenge for the Dozier investigation in Florida: the records that were found often were incomplete or contained conflicting information.
And the key in both these scenarios is for researchers to cross-check information as thoroughly as possible. That means going and getting all different sorts of records, all different types of records, and always cross-check everything. You don't want to make assumptions or think that, you kind of figured out one answer if you only have one line of evidence. So whether, the schools kept records, in this case, the church sent kept records that were, separate. There would have been reports back to the government, the federal government or state government, whatever agency was overseeing them. Death certificates, other types of mortality statistics, if they're kept locally. And so you have to really dig through, sometimes even coroner reports or courthouse records, because if there was a case of something that happened that was investigated, then there'd be records for that. So you really have to go get each of these types of data and then cross-reference them and try to put together that picture, because they'll all have a little different story to tell. It never matches up exactly, but it helps you then kind of figure out the minimum number of people, you know, the minimum names of who we should be looking for. You know, at least we know the main chronology of what happened. And that can be the challenge and really what's very time consuming. But I think that when you get into each of those different avenues and start saying, okay, what are each of them telling us and comparing them, is when you really start to see the story, you know, what happened come to life.
There were three main incidents at the Dozier School that led to the deaths. There was a 1914 dormitory fire. There were also the flu epidemics of 1918 and 1932. There were also sporadic unsuccessful escapes, and there was also sexual abuse. I asked Erin Kimmerly about surprises during the investigation.
Well, for me, one of the things that I thought was most surprising was how much of an effort school officials made throughout history. Like, you know, when each of these sort of incidents, like you mentioned, would occur. Okay, there was a fire, there was a flu epidemic. And I would just digress a second to say that that was often cited as reasons, you know, because there was a lot of opposition to the work we did early on, and people say, well, it, you know, half, you know, so many people died in the flu, right? It was a flu epidemic, like, you expect that. So, you know, like, there's nothing malicious, and, you know, we should accept it. And the challenge with that is, and what we found is that, yes, you know, there was a flu epidemic, and there were deaths that occurred, but what we found is during segregation on the colored side, school officials left the black children unattended for days. No food, no medicine, no electricity. The state physician came back and found them and said the dead were piling up. And so there's a certain culpability and responsibility. And that was our position. And I think, you know, for this as well. I mean, the government takes the children away and they don't give them back. That's the bottom line. They're responsible for their care and well-being. So even if there is a flu or a fire, they're responsible for their safety and well-being. Abandoning them, not providing adequate medicine or food or care is not acceptable. And so at the time when those facts would come out, the public was outraged. There would be national news stories of outrage. And the school would hire basically a publicist, issue their own press releases, come up with their own investigation. So now for all these historic incidences, we'll have like an investigative report of two or three of them from the school, from the coroner, from the legislature, all with a different conclusion, all with a different number of dead, all different names of who died. And it was this real effort on the part of the school to control its public image and to stay open. And that's one of the things I think will be very interesting with the Indian schools, is to see historically, you know, how hard did school administrators, whether it was the church or the, you know, military, I think, you know, Carlisle School in Pennsylvania has received a lot of attention for burials and children that died, and some of those have been repatriated to their families. So, you know, how hard was the school administrators or the government fighting to keep these schools open in the face of controversy at the time? And that's not what I expected early on, you know, going into this, but it was really interesting and I think significant because of that, it's really hard to get a clear picture in the historic record.
What was the feeling going through all your work when you were able to, for the families that you're able to possibly identify the remains and get the name, tell the story as best as you could, and provide that information to the families to give them closure after so many years, to answer questions, unanswered questions that they may have had for lifetimes. What was the feeling for you as an anthropologist, as a scientist, to be able to provide that for those people?
You know, it's hard to even describe that feeling. I came to know a lot of those families very well, worked very hard. I felt like on their behalf, you know, we were doing this for them. The position I've always taken in my work and that our institute tries to uphold is this idea that everyone deserves access to the justice system. And this is about providing that access so that whatever the problem is, time or jurisdiction or something else, is like an obstacle that can be overcome. They deserve the truth, and they have a right to have those remains returned to them. So that for us, it was just became, you know, very sort of personal for them. And many of them, you know, they were in their 70s or 80s when we started working together. It really truly had been a lifetime that they were looking for their missing brothers. And so I'm really happy that for those, for all those families that we were working with, we were able to find them and to find, I don't even say like it's closure. I don't think that they ever feel that. I just think that they have knowledge and it's, you know, and they can accept it. It's like, you can't really grieve in a way when you don't even know what happened. You have so many questions, you know, why can't the government return my brother's body? It's, you know, very, because this is the kind of work we do all the time, right? And that's the thing, like even what, you know, what they're doing in Canada. I mean, law enforcement, anthropology, we have a lot of tools and technology. We do this work every day successfully. So it's not about capacity, right? It's about the will to know the truth and to do it.
Based on your investigation, all the years that you have invested along with your team, people from many different disciplines that combined their efforts, their talents, and their technology, what can those in Kamloops and, you know, wider community here in British Columbia, what can we all expect to unfold over the years to come? And do you have any advice or key learnings to those who will be on the ground, who will be doing the same work that you did and your team did? Any advice or key learnings that you can impart to them?
I guess my advice would be to just to really, I think, stay focused on the Indigenous communities and those families. That is who this is ultimately for, and who wants it done and has a right to have it done, and that's the message that should be, you know, central to like their effort and you know, going forward. It's the right position, the right place to be. So they should, you know, I hopefully feel confident in that and always put that forward first. And just understand that justice comes in a lot of different forms. You know, we tend to fall back and want it to be criminal prosecution for good reason, but sometimes that's not possible. You know, I mentioned at the beginning, sometimes those who are responsible are deceased, or there's the statute of limitations. It turns out it wasn't a crime, which, you know, today is a crime. Then it wasn't a crime. It was national policy. So there's lots of reasons that, you know, our modern sense of what is justice will let us down, but that sometimes truth itself is justice, and that is enough and should be enough to go forward. And then just to check everything, because like I said, it's really going to be about detailed, you know, science in the sense of being real meticulous in the details to get at what, you know, what is there.
That was Professor Aaron Kimmerly, forensic anthropologist from the University of South Florida in Tampa, Florida. She is the leader of the investigation of unmarked graves at the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna, Florida. In 2017, the state of Florida formally apologized to the victims and families. It also paid to reinter their remains. There were no criminal charges. Detectives were able to identify employees between 1949 and 1971, but all but one of them had died. If you need it, the National Indian Residential School Crisis Line is open around the clock. Call 1-866-925-4419. That's 1-866-925-4419 if you need to talk to someone.
Vaccine, when it's your turn, go get it, please don't wait.
That's the sound of the YVR Pop Choir, also known as the Chorus Studio, with its topical take on Dolly Parton's Maxine, called Vaccine. You can find it on YouTube.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to adventurers and scientists who go where few dare to explore. It's Caves and Karst Day in BC on June 6th, and this year is International Year of Caves and Karst. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
So I'm very happy that I'm going to get my Moderna shot today. And I wanted to tell everybody, I think you should get out there and do it too. I even changed one of my songs to fit the occasion. It goes, vaccine, 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 vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
Those are the sounds of country music legend and actress Dolly Parton on Twitter. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 6th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on June 6th in 1933, the first drive-in theater opened in Camden, New Jersey? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. You can be like recent supporters, Chris Vernon, Ken Denike, John O'Flynn, and Brian Ferguson. Thank you all. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.